Few tales are told of Hades, whose very name inspires fear and penitence, reminding us of the inevitable fate which we all share. I, however, mean to tell you such a tale. Listen carefully.
So we keep alluding to Hades, but we keep failing to actually talk about Hades. And I want to do that. Finally, I want to finally get into it, because I personally believe that Hades is a really excellent game for thinking about the problem of immersion in games and sort of the obsession with the concept of immersion in games. Because I actually feel like Hades is anti-immersion. You may disagree.
Okay. No,
by the way, this is the Footy Dashi podcast, everyone. How you doing? I'm here with Lauren.
Yep, this is me. I am Lauren, and I am not going to disagree because I am going to entertain Nicholas on this thought.
If you don't want to entertain me, if you want to disagree, just go right ahead.
No, I actually, no, I don't have any strong opinions either way. I want to see where this goes before I formulate an opinion.
So thesis, here we go. Here's our thesis statement, since we both come from humanities backgrounds. So our thesis, my thesis is Hades is anti-immersion precisely because even though it uses a lot of the tropes in that video games typically do use to try and get you immersed in a like character's story or game world, there are a lot of really interesting things that it does to sort of break that. In other words, it both uses the tropes and it shows you the tropes. And by showing them to you and sort of like revealing them to you in the course of the gameplay, it actually breaks immersion in a really productive and interesting way. Full stop. That's my thesis. And so I base that upon the fact that, okay, so if I occasionally refer to the character as Zagreus, it's because, well, as Lauren knows, we both study classics, like Zagreus is how you actually pronounce it. Zagreus, as they call him in the game. Zagreus.
We just call him Zaggy.
Zag.
Little Zagster.
So
yeah, Zagsterk's the only way to get through is to zag through everything.
I am going to attempt to talk about the game without spoiling it, but one of the basic things that you need to understand is that sort of the way the game functions is that it uses failure in a really interesting way. And what I mean is that in many ways, you have to fail in order to progress. The game will, you actually cannot, like you cannot progress from like point A in the plot of the game to point Z without failing. And in fact, actually without failing multiple times. So the thing is, like you can actually get through the levels without failing. In other words, it is possible with like the basic, I think you start off with the sword. So you can with like the first weapon that you get and with absolutely no power-ups whatsoever and just like the boons that you acquire through the course of like going through the various rooms, you can get through all of the what people would typically think of as like the game, all of sort of the roguelike elements of the game. The problem is that's not the game. That's a part of the game.
And I'd actually even like to point out that the mechanic of the roguelikes in the genre itself, like failure, losing your equipment, right? Losing your health, losing those power-ups right throughout, with maybe minor progression throughout. So that means minor skill boosts or minor right power-ups. It is very possible to get to the third boss with your first playthrough if you are just a master at roguelikes.
Yeah.
You can get through all three bosses. Roguelikes typically do have those bosses, right?
Yeah.
Just like honestly though, if you've only ever played Mario, just like the Mario world from the N64 or the Super Nintendo, where you go through different levels
yeah.
and get to, you know, Bowser at point A, and then he's like, ha ha ha, I'm still exciting. And then you get to him second and then third and stuff like that. So are typically, right, all of these bosses. I guess Mega Man, excuse me, I like choked there a little. Mega Man would be a better example, where there's the different boss stages until you get to the final boss.
Yeah.
But it is possible to get through the experience of the game without failing, but you will not experience the game and its story.
Yes.
If you do not engage in the failure mechanic.
Exactly. And that's what's really interesting to me about it, is because if you play the game in sort of the conventional way, in the way that sort of, in many ways, most games like it, that are similar to it, not even just roguelikes, but games that involve sort of like basic stage progression, like, as you said, just like a Mario game involves basic stage progression. If you play it in the way that those games sort of implicitly want you to play them, to be as successful as possible as you get through them, you experience very little. And you understand, this is sort of like, okay, so we have our thesis statement, like section one of the hypothetical paper that this contributes yes. to. So section one is all about the fact that, like, your understanding is more limited the less you fail. In other words, in order to have a proper understanding of what the game is in its totality and what it's trying to say to you, not just in terms of its narrative, but also in terms of, like, sort of the subjective experience that you as a player have by sort of performing what it is that this character Zagreus wants you to do, like, you don't get that if you don't fail. In other words, if you have to actually reject the convention. And this is what I mean by sort of like it's anti-immersion, because immersion depends upon that way in which people typically play games, where they get into it, they get into a flow and they're progressing and everything sort of falls seamlessly and everything's just sort of working. But the thing is, in order to actually experience the game in its totality, you have to break yourself of that.
And what's interesting?
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Nah, what's interesting about it is also from the convention of a roguelike, you are expected to fail. However, it is not the convention of gaming in general that you want to fail.
Exactly.
So on Bloodborne, for example, is another great, or any of the Dark Souls or Souls-like genre,
yeah.
Which is now a thing, yeah. is that you are expected to fail, but you as a person do not want to fail. You want to recover your items. You want to progress the game and you want to get better.
And I would add, more importantly, also in many ways, the game doesn't want you to fail. That expecting you to fail and wanting you to fail are different things.
Yes. And so from the game design standpoint, when we look at Hades, what I've really enjoyed about it is that it breaks convention. Right, as you're saying, but does that actually break immersion? It wants you to do a thing that you were not used to conventionally wanting to do. Yes. Does that mean that if you defy or subvert your expectations, or you subvert convention of a genre, does that mean that you are undoubtedly breaking the immersion? Right? Is it not possible? Right. So yeah. as it's not the devil's advocate for antithesis, but to go through this whole paper, right?
Yeah.
In section one, the other argument that you would bring in to say that, look at my unbiased paper, would be, do you, right? When you subvert those expectations and you are stating that you must fail and want to fail, which in even other roguelikes, you really don't want to fail in Spelunky.
No.
You just happen to fail, but yeah. you don't want to do it. In Hades, you know, honestly, for me on God mode, like, I might literally just fail in that first room every time.
Okay,
and I know that sounds.
I want to interject something because you
brought
God mode, and God mode is interesting here because, again, it's this question of, like, what is the convention? What is God mode conventionally in games? It's invincibility. It's sort of a way to sort of, like, protect yourself from the game, essentially, and its mechanics.
In the older games, it used to be called God mode, because they're like, now you're the god. That's all I just wanted to say.
Well, so if I recall, I may be wrong about this, but sort of the one game that I can think of that sort of concretizes this in a really interesting way is actually in Doom, where God mode, literally, you then also lose all of your weapons and you just have this kind of floating, like, glowy hand. And the floating glowy hand, like, shoots out a beam, or actually I think it's like a ball of energy that does infinite damage, as if it was just like God smiting things. And so, like, it really, like, puts you in
the subjective. I am not going to lie to you. I don't remember if that's Doom or not, but I've seen the clips.
I think it's Doom. I think it's Doom.
Yeah. We'll just go with Doom, and then we can both be proven wrong later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, continue with your antithesis.
No, yeah. So, oh my gosh. I think God mode is an incredible thing. So, in my antithesis within this for objectivism, is that if a tenet of the game is to break or subvert that convention, if it serves the purpose of narrative immersion, right? Now, the story needs the convention to be broken.
Yes.
Right? Because the narrative and the narration of the experience, and this will actually get into section two, which I kind of want to talk about as well, which we can call Shakespeare's Chorus.
Yeah.
And is that when we look at the narrative of Hades and we look at his journey through the experience, it's not just because the player is coming at a point where he's just starting to want to break free. Yeah. In the narrative, you come at a point where he's been doing this. And so even though you, the player, are like not getting very far, or maybe you've gotten super far and then they're like, whoa, you made it really far, right? Every AI and NPC's interaction is all because he's been trying to escape for quite some time.
Yeah.
Right? And so in the narrative, he has failed. So they need you to fail to get that narrative, which means that it actually makes it, in a narrative standpoint, more immersive, because now the mechanic is directly tied to his relationship to all of the people around him.
Okay, so actually that is a really good point. And I think it leads to a need to, this is something you also often have to do in academic papers, which is define your terms. So the thing is, like, what you're talking about is narrative immersion, the way in which one becomes involved or engaged with the story or sort of the kind of diffuse plot of a game. Strangely, what I'm talking about is actually sort of a more subjective immersion of the person playing the game. So I think you're correct if what you're talking about is narrative immersion, like getting involved in the story or becoming immersed in the story. What I'm saying is that it breaks subjective immersion. And that's why I referred to earlier that concept of, like, the almost sort of visceral experience that you can have sometimes in playing a game where, and I mean, it's oftentimes referred to as flow. It's called different things by different people, but it is that it's almost a physiological reaction that you have where you get into a pattern, you get into a cycle of moving your hands, of your, you know, hand-eye coordination, all of those things where everything is working and it's almost seamless. What I'm saying is that the game breaks that. And it breaks that precisely so as to immerse you in the manner that you're talking about. In other words, it's very easy to become distracted from the narrative of a game by becoming immersed in the way that I'm talking about, this more subjective form of immersion. And so in many ways, the designers, maybe implicitly, maybe they even understood this, but they recognized that in order to have that understanding, that sort of more intellectual engagement with the plot and the narrative and the story structure, you actually have to break that more quote unquote natural, like almost physiological reaction that players have when they feel quote unquote immersed in a game.
I would say with the physiological reaction to it, it's about the actual act of interactivity.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about immersion in games, we're not talking about, I'm so immersed in this book, I need to keep reading. I'm so immersed in this movie, I need to keep watching. I'm so immersed in this series, I'm going to binge all 10 episodes and they're each an hour long.
Yeah.
Right? That's 10 hours of your life gone.
That is your day gone.
That is your day gone, right? And because that's the type of flow. It is. Yeah. You're really enjoyed and you're engaged and you're immersed. But when you're interacting with something in games, it's interactive immersion. It's immersion at that. I like that you called it the physiological level, because it's an immersion where you're so invested in the gameplay. You're so invested in the mechanics. You're so invested in the systems. But you just keep playing. And for me, I think a game that hits on that really well is something we have talked about in the past, and that's World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
That's a game where everything is, quite honestly, a world and a world state that allows you to completely put yourself into a place where you would be doing it, because it really mirrors daily life. You're assigned tasks that you need to complete, that you level up yourself, gain more skills to do better tasks better and quicker. And well, then you just
capitalistic form of daily life. But no, you're correct.
I'm correct. I mean, no, you get up, you have to make your coffee. You got to go get your world buffs. There's a routine, right? There's habits, there's convention, there's things that you understand you can do. And even there is a routine and a rotation that you get into with your skills, right?
Yeah, it's true.
So at a very subconscious level, World of Warcraft is creating this experience that easily allows for this type of what you call subjective immersion. I might call it world or interactive immersion, because I do think that narrative immersion does exist in games, and those exist in the games where you get into the flow of like Uncharted. I've really only played Uncharted 2.
Yeah.
But in Uncharted 2, where you get into the different flows and you have different gameplay scenes, which are then part of the narrative that are propelling you forward.
Yeah, yeah.
That then make you watch a cutscene, right? And then honestly, this is why a trope of mini games has been gameplay, cutscene, gameplay that sets up, cutscene, gameplay, cutscene. And it was because it does give enough pacing and break to allow players to experience the game and experience the story.
Yeah.
Right. And so that type of subjective immersion, if you will, I really like the term subjective immersion, but what I really think we're talking about is that experiential immersion, the immersion of consistent playing, right? Yeah. Versus subjective immersion, which some people could argue for Hades is, well, no, I keep playing and I talk to all of the people and then I keep playing. Like, I know people that really enjoy it. But for me, I would agree that immersion was somewhat broken because I'm just not a player that likes to lose progress.
That right there. You're not the kind of player who likes to lose progress. I think that is sort of like the conventional attitude that I couldn't quite describe. And it's that sense of, like, as you said, so when, you know, when you're talking about a game like really any of these sort of more narratively focused games, I mean, it's not just Uncharted. It could be any of the Naughty Dog games, but it could also be even something as, like, I don't know, the original Unreal game, or it could even literally be Mario. It's this idea that, like, I as a player know where I'm at in the game, and I know how much further I have to go. And it pisses me off when I lose that understanding of where I'm at and either have to go back. Like, it's the same reason why people get irritated when they have to go back in a game. It's because, like, oh, I had gotten to a point and now I've been thrown back. And the thing is, Hades does that to you constantly. And it's very unforgiving. And it's very unforgiving because in many ways, and I think that sort of, unlike a game like Dark Souls or sort of those, like, really brutal like third person games, the game, I think Hades as a game actually wants you to go back in that way. It wants you to not necessarily lose progress, but it wants you to understand how strange losing that conventional understanding of progress can actually lead you to a different understanding of progress. That's what I think the game wants you to understand. And I keep saying in these terms, like, wanting you to understand, because it's not just about achieving in the game. It's also about, like, knowing what you're doing, understanding what you're doing, because your situation is, I'm going to finish. I'm going to let you talk, but let me finish. it's because it's not just about, so if you as a player are in many ways analogous to Zagreus in the game, you have to do the same thing that Zagreus does. You actually have to become disillusioned. Zagreus's disillusion is more sort of experienced in narrative terms about his parentage and so forth and so forth. But your disillusion as a player is actually more in terms of shedding those conventions. And as you said, that feeling of having made progress, or like that conventional understanding of having made progress. Sorry, go ahead.
Don't apologize, because you were leading directly into what I'm going to call section two. And we're going to call this Shakespeare's Chorus and the designer-driven design.
Okay.
Right? So just like we do in academic papers, we need to kind of identify, right, our terms here.
Yeah.
You should actually identify what Shakespeare's Chorus is, because I have forgotten any. I only have a layman's terms, right? And I will identify it in layman's terms.
I only understand this very, like, so I'm not an English scholar, I'm a Japanese scholar. So I only understand this in the most vague terms. But basically, it's this idea that, like, In any given Shakespeare play, although not all of them, but in most of them, there is generally at least one character, or you could say an assemblage of characters, who represent a kind of common voice. And when I say common voice, it's the voice of sort of like the culture or the society or sort of like a broader public opinion, if such a thing existed, in the play. Now, traditionally in the theatrical arts, particularly in ancient tragedy, this function was literally a bunch of people. It literally was a chorus. It was a whole bunch of people who, like, say in the Oedipus Tyrannos, where like it's the elders of Thebes, and their whole function in the play is to be like, no, Oedipus, you're a dumbass. You don't actually understand what's going on. You're failing to see the bigger picture. And so then the chorus is there to remind the audience of what that bigger picture is. In Shakespeare, this is typically a particular character. Probably the quintessential example of this is the character Falstaff in the Henry V plays. So there's Henry V part one, part two, et cetera. Sorry for the interruption, everyone. Just a little editorial note. I was actually right the first time. It is, in fact, Henry IV, not Henry V. Apologies. Now back to your regularly scheduled programming. Falstaff is an invented person. Doesn't exist, but is probably based upon actual historical figures. Henry V obviously is a real historical figure. He was King of England at one point. But Falstaff's function in that play is to both be a foil to the king, but also to represent a kind of common perspective. Because the play, all of the characters in the play are these, you know, these aristocrats, they're the nobility and so forth. So there isn't really much opportunity to embody that idea of like the common opinion in any of them, because they're all bougie assholes. Sorry. So this character Falstaff serves this function, or the character of let's modernize this just a little bit
for our listeners, because so Falstaff, right, is in the play because they're all bougie assholes. But if you want to take some really great modern terminology, we're going to look at C-3PO and Han Solo. Yes. Those are your two chorus characters in all of Star Wars, right? You've got the guy that's like, look, I don't care about your stupid religion. I know that a blaster shoots straight, and that, you know, ships fly fast.
Yes.
And there's science to why, right, Darth Vader is on top.
Yeah.
Right. And then you have C-3PO, who's like, why are we in the middle of a desert? You're crazy. I'm not following you, R2.
Yeah.
And throughout the whole series, right, C-3PO is, you know, he's the guy. I know he's a droid, but for a droid, he's really scared. He's telling everybody they're crazy. And it's under the impression, right, that he's being logical, right? That he is in the real world, that he is the common sense popular opinion telling everybody the odds.
Yeah.
And then Han Solo is the human foil to that, which is, I'm telling everybody, like, don't tell me the odds.
Yeah.
But also, like, hey, this is still crazy. The Force still doesn't exist. I can't see it. I can't feel it. Also, of course, don't you love me, Leia? Of course you do, because I'm beautiful, well, right? Like, he's that common,
yeah,
common aspect.
And what Han Solo and Falstaff have in common is that they both are of a particular world, but they also have an ironic detachment from it.
Yes. Yep. And so I think that's really important when you look at Hades and why I really enjoy it, because also the chorus is also a very ancient, as you were saying with the ancient tragedies, for those of you who don't know, coming from classics, the ancient tragedies is a Greek, you know, that is a Greek thing. This comes straight from Aristotle. And when I look at Shakespeare's chorus, I'm talking about the different and NPC individuals that you have to return to every single time you fail, right? This is why this is section two.
Yeah.
Because in section one, we talked about how your understanding is limited if you do not fail.
Yeah.
And it is limited because of Shakespeare's chorus. In order to not only understand more about your story, to create that detachment for yourself and the character,
yep,
but you have to engage with every single person, and you actually learn more the more that you fail. And you learn more because those chorus characters are all existing right within your home.
Yeah.
Right. You have Nyx, you have Hades, you have Achilles,
at one point,
the Gorgon.
Yeah, there's Thanatos. You eventually meet Orpheus and Eurydice. Megara as well, Medusa, or Dusa as she's called in the
Dusa.
Game.
Yeah. Yeah, she's so cute. I love her.
She's cute, actually.
But yeah, she's so cute. And she's so nervous. But you have this home that you kind of return to, and that's your chorus. That's the real world. That's the common, right?
Yeah.
And going back to what you were saying, Nicholas, about what the game wants you to feel and wants you to think.
Yeah.
And coming to that kind of like, you feel dejected because you're always coming back. It wants you to see that chorus perspective because it's reminding you, right, about what you're doing and what's actually going on in the world. And it's reminding you about what that bigger picture is.
Yeah.
And for a lot of the perspective of the game and for the progression, you don't know the bigger picture.
Yep.
And in order, failure, right, is one of those mechanics of the genre that it's using to show you that bigger picture.
Yeah.
And if you just got through the entire experience and you missed all of that story, you end up, you do actually finish the experience and you literally have no idea why you even won. You will actually get some spoilers, in air quotes, about a very key figure in the protagonist's life,
yes.
I will say, that you will never see in the story, but you can actually progress all the way to the point where he starts mentioning why, like, he wants to find this key figure, and you will never have heard that person mentioned.
Yeah.
Right. If you have never failed until that point. I know this because one of my friends is super into roguelikes and he just barreled through to that part and went, oh, I only know that this is important because I actually watched you play and I had failed like 10 or 12 times already.
Well, and what's interesting is that the game then, once you do meet that key person, then actually forces you to fail. Like at that point,
yes,
it will, you can't do anything about it. It will send you back because it's like, okay, you did everything, like, but strangely enough, in many ways, like by adopting Zagreus's perspective, I've got to get out of hell. I've got to do it as efficiently as possible. I've got to do the standard thing that a player is supposed to do in a game like this. If you do that, the game, when you reach that quote unquote final point, will tell you, no, you did it all wrong. Go back. Like literally.
And that is a very big Greek trope. Right.
Yeah.
And this is where I want to go into what I was talking about is Shakespeare's chorus and the designer driven design methodologies, because there are two very key points of design methodologies that you can have. And we brought up kind of one with subjective immersion, and that's going to be called player driven design. That's also player driven mechanics, player driven story, yeah, whatever you want to call it. Player driven design is when the player themselves are driving how the game progresses. They are put in power. They are put in control. And you're going to see this in a lot of games, particularly in their game mechanics, right? You're going to see it in Bloodborne with what types of weapons that you choose to upgrade, the skills that you decide to purchase. In Hades, it's the boons that you decide that you want to equip, right? Sure.
Yeah.
But also, right, the game has what it wants you to do because it'll just randomly generate a lot of things and randomly do.
Yeah.
But then you can take that control by equipping a trinket or something that then determines what boons will drop, etc.
Yeah.
In typical platformers, you usually don't see this too often because platformers, while say more modern AAA gaming like Uncharted or like Ghost of Tsushima with the different power-ups that you can do, Spider-Man, right, with skills, any game with skills really.
Yeah.
Minus World of Warcraft in this case, or modern World of Warcraft in this case.
Yeah.
Player-driven design is all about making the player feel in control, the player is in charge, and the player is what drives the story forward, whether it's just completing a level or not.
Yeah.
Platformers, however, are all designer-driven design because you have to get from point A to point B. You just have to go through the level.
Yeah.
Maybe there's going to be a couple hidden areas, or maybe there's a couple of hidden power-ups. And then, yeah, sure, you feel in control because you're exploring it, but the designer put it there for you to explore.
Yeah.
Designer-driven design is also in a lot of these games, just in general, where you need to complete 5 missions to get a better cutscene.
Yeah.
You have to do the story missions to get the story. Sure, it's an open world game like Skyrim, but if you don't do the main Dragonborn quests, you're not going to get any of the powers and you're just kind of living in a sandbox,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So maybe it doesn't force you, but the designer-driven design is there. Even more so, I would say, in a sandbox like Minecraft or in like Skyrim, the designer driven is completely in that game,
yeah,
because you are so bound by the rules, mechanics, and the systems of that experience that you are not allowed to impose your, you could say, will upon the world.
And that's exactly what I was, and what I meant earlier when I said, to get people to think about, like, what does the game want you to do? What does the game want of you?
Yes.
Rather than just like, what does it expect you to do?
And that's why it's called designer driven versus player driven, yeah, because designer driven is, I have something I want you to feel, I want you to see, I want you to do.
Yeah.
I am going to design the experience so that you do it. And Supergiant's been really, really great about this in designer driven narrative. And I think they've been great about it in designer driven gameplay mechanics as well. But in Hades, I feel that the designer-driven methodologies have really been defined in terms of its narrative.
Yeah.
Because they had amazing gameplay and they had amazing narrative in Transistor. It's like, right, same in Bastion, same in Pyre, though I never finished it, so I don't really like commenting on their titles that I haven't finished. But I feel like I can do it with Hades because I've experienced so much of this refinement that I've gotten this experience that they want.
Yeah.
What does the game want, right? And then what does the player want or expect?
Expect, yeah.
Right? And Hades does something where they look at the designer-driven methodology and they have utilized Shakespeare's chorus to try to align these two, right?
Yeah.
Values, you could say,
yeah,
into a common goal. And when you mentioned Zagreus being dejected and feeling, what was the word? Depraved?
Dejected is probably just a better.
Dejected is just a better word.
Yeah.
Feeling dejected. The only way that they have been able to do that is to say, your expectation of progression is gone.
Yeah.
We're subverting that. Your trials that you will need to face and the bigger picture that you must understand is only if you fail.
Yeah.
And by doing so, they have actually allowed, right, the narrative has now completely filled in that expectation gap.
Yeah.
So now you have this power, expectation of your power and your progression. You're constantly being shut down. Zagreus as a character is like, no, I have to meet that expectation. He meets the player's expectations of themselves playing the game.
Yeah.
And Shakespeare chorus all around you is telling you there's a bigger picture.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, I'm playing a game. Shut up.
Yeah.
And then, exactly. I mean, yeah, you know, to him, he's like, no, I'm getting out of here. Shut up.
Yeah.
Until finally, boom, you fail and you realize, wait a second, maybe I'm not just, right,
yeah,
trying to escape. Maybe I'm not just playing a game.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where I feel like it hits that narrative immersion for me, just so, right.
And that's the thing,
but leads to the thesis.
Yeah. So to deal with this problem of like embodying the sort of the broader perspective in these individual characters like Nyx, who is initially presented as, if not his mother, then at least a mother figure. And then that gets subverted over the course of the story. And then the relationship between Hades and Zagreus, which is initially presented as the sort of like stereotypical, like, oh, I'm the domineering father and you're just the upstart teen. Like, there are all these like conventional relationship frameworks that you see throughout the game and the way the game presents the story to you, but it slowly dissolves them. In other words, it's fascinating because it first feeds you the conventions. It's like, here, like, you understand this relationship between Hades and Zagreus. It's just like, perhaps, like, if you are a teenage boy playing this game, you're like, yeah, I hate my dad too. He's a jerk. But the thing is, Hades never stops being a jerk. He's kind of a jerk the entire time. But again, what the game forces you to do through its sort of like failure system is to understand him. And you may not necessarily ever come around to agreeing with him or sympathizing with him, but you will understand him in the same way that you will understand this key person that Zagreus is trying to find. You will understand Nyx's position. And in fact, to me, one of the most fascinating examples of this is actually Megara. Megara is a boss. In fact, she's the first boss you encounter. So in Tartarus, you get to the end of Tartarus, and she's there and you have to fight her, and she's kind of kinky and cool. And I actually think she's a great character, but also the thing is, then you encounter, if you defeat Megara. So then when you, after that, if you fail and then go back to the beginning stages with, you know, the hall and Hades and so forth, you will then encounter her outside of that context. In other words, it's almost like, let's imagine, you know, you're playing Mario, you're playing like a Mario RPG, you get through like, you know, the first stage, you defeat like minor Bowser or like Bowser Jr. Now that there are like 4,000 Bowsers, which I find very strange. So you defeat Bowser Jr. or Ludwig or one of the others. But then you fail and you have to go back. And then at like, say, the bar in like the town where you start, you encounter Bowser Jr. and you have a conversation with him and you start talking with him. He's like, well, how did you feel when I beat you? And Bowser Jr. is like, kind of sucked. It was kind of terrible. I didn't like it. Why did you do that?
Yeah.
And then you as Mario, like,
and that's
and that's the relationship that you end up having with Megara in the game. Like, you actually have to kind of relate to her as someone that you defeated. And that's
no, it's not only fascinating. It's what's, I think, really gotten people to kind of talk about Hades in this way, is that it has taken something that everyone just assumed was the right way to do something.
Yep.
And that's like, that's just how games are, and has gone, but what if it wasn't, right? Yeah. And it's made you, you know, relate to everybody and everything in a way that really is like Shakespeare's Chorus, I think, taken up to a huge notch.
Yeah.
Where everybody is now the bigger picture.
Yes.
Everybody you meet is that perspective. I mean, even Charon, who is he's just like a vendor.
Yeah.
The longer you go on, the more and more you kind of discover about him just by purchasing, or just kind of by meeting him, right?
And this is a pseudo spoiler, but Karen ends up being an extremely key figure in like the latter stages of the game's narrative. And so, yeah, this character that you encounter is just like the, like, nonverbal that you buy power-ups from. Like, he actually figures very prominently in the way the game resolves itself.
Yeah. And I mean, I love that. I love it, because especially as a writer, right? Anytime like you as a writer, you're like, I really want to have people experience this. I really want to have people read this. I want them to think about this. Like, this can be anything, right? It could be Cheez-Its. Like, I really just want people to come away from this. And I'm like, man, all I want to do is eat a box of Cheez-Its. Like, that's great. but no, just to say that it can be that visceral, that tangible.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Right?
I like Cheez-Its. So that's why I find it funny.
Perfect. Yeah. You're like, that's all I want from this. I'm a writer and that's all I want. Then as a game designer, right, I look at it and I'm like, man, like, I really want the player, though, to have the choice. I want the player to choose that they're going to eat the box of Cheez-Its, because they've just experienced it in the game. And now they're like, man, I'm choosing the Cheez-Its. Man, I'm feeling about the Cheez-Its. But now I'm experiencing eating the Cheez-It in the game. But I think I chose that. I think I'm the one that told myself I needed to eat Cheez-Its, not the game.
Yeah.
That, I think, is what Hades is capable of for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that is what's incredible. And that is why, and the antithesis of this stage, I am here to say that, like, it may show you the tropes and it may break the tropes, but is it actually breaking the immersion if it is able to actually connect those two things to where the player thinks that they're the ones that has uncovered this story?
Yeah.
But the game is the one that wanted you to engage with those unconventional mechanics that has actually made you think that you uncovered the story.
I think the answer is yes, actually. No, and the thing is, and it's precisely because this is interesting.
Yes,
how,
and then we'll go to section three.
Yeah, because in many ways, this does lead right into what will be section three. So we've constructed here a kind of like dialectical argument where, I mean, literally, I posited a thesis, you posited the antithesis, and here we go. It's synthesis time. So synthesis time. The reason why I would say yes has to do with, so I made Lauren do some reading, and Lauren probably hates me for making her do this, but I wanted to look at, so interestingly enough, we've almost inverted the traditional like academic paper, because now I'm going to go into like the theoretical part, whereas normally in an academic paper, you begin with the theory, like you describe what the theory that you're working with is first. Now we're
this is about breaking convention.
Exactly,
here.
We broke the convention. We did a different kind of argument. All right, so I'm going to talk a bit about Brecht, Bertolt Brecht. I'm not going to talk extensively about him. I just want to talk about one thing from his like almost voluminous writings on like theoretical writings on theater. And it's this concept known, it's translated a whole bunch of different ways. It used to be translated as the alienation effect, or the distancing effect, or the estrangement effect. In German, it's Verfremdungseffekt. And I'll break that down, so that, because I think it's actually important to understand what this, how this word works etymologically. So in Verfremdungseffekt, you have three components. You have a prefix, ver. You have a sort of root noun that is actually genitive in this case. So Fremdungs, like stranger, or like it's sort of a stranger. And then effect, which is actually the same in German as it is in English. It's just effect. That they mean the same thing. There's no difference in nuance, really. Okay, so so I'm going to begin with the middle, sort of the stranger part. So it's the effect of like estranging, although estranging is even not quite right. If you wanted it to be perfectly, like if you wanted a perfect calc from German into English, the word you would actually want to use is forestranging effect or forestranger's effect. And the reason why is because the Ver in German means is a kind of intensification. So it's not just that you're being alienated or you're being put in the position of an other. It's like an intensified position of othering. It's not just like you're being put outside of what's going on. You're being alienated from it. You're being sort of de-immersed. It's like you're being forcefully de-immersed. And that's what the Ver means here. And then the effect, obviously, as I said before, that kind of makes sense. Now, this is relate. Now, so Brecht was a Marxist. And so, again, I get to play the cartoon Marxist. Aha, yeah! I'm here to talk about some Marxism, yeah. This is related to a concept from Marx, which is often also translated as alienation or estrangement. Although in his case, estrangement actually is an appropriate translation because the German is Entfremdungs. Or Entfremdung, sorry. The S at the end makes it genitive. And in his case, sort of that is like sort of being put in the state of othering. And what's different about sort of Marx's conception of othering is that it's more like it's a thing that kind of builds over time as a result of living under capitalism. You become alienated from the products of your labor as a result of sort of these broader forces that are sort of bearing down on you. And they're sort of slowly but steadily turning you into a kind of person who no longer has the quote unquote natural relationship to like the things that they do in life. But what Brecht is talking about, since he's talking about an art form, is an art form that like pushes you into that position. It compels you to think and to be in those terms. And how does this play out in the theater? Well, it's the idea that you are not allowed to suspend disbelief. Brecht was a big believer in this thing. It's not a term he coined, but he theorized it much better, called the epic theater. And the whole thing that underpins the epic theater is this notion that you as an audience member can't just sort of like comfortably sit back, relax, and take it all in. That the play that you're about to see is going to present itself to you in such a forceful and aggressive way that you're not going to be able to become immersed in it. In other words, it's going to, in the same way that I'm arguing that Hades sort of breaks that sort of expectation of, as Lauren, as you said, of progression or like the achievement of progression, or as I called it, subjective immersion, the play, or at least the Brechtian play, is going to put you as an audience member in a position where you actually have to not only confront what's going on before you, but you also have to confront yourself in relationship to it. And so the reason why I think this is useful for sort of bridging the point that you're making and the point that I'm making is that for Brecht, that is 100% an intended effect. Like he constructs his artistic production in such a way that it will, as you just said, like make you want the Cheez-It. Although in his case, what he wants you to do is to sort of like think politically about the circumstances in which you find yourself and the way in which the play reflects that. And so similarly, what Hades is doing as a game, and it is doing it to you, and I'm pretty sure that the designers knew that they were doing it to you, so you're correct about that. But what it is still putting you as a player in that, in a position analogous to what Brecht is trying to do to his audience member. In other words, it's not allowing you to slide easily into those conventional expectations. It may allow you to initially adopt them, but as the work of art, either the game or the play progresses, it's going to make that position untenable. Full stop. So what do you think? Did I synthesize?
Yeah, that's a great synthesis. So to your thesis, I have to say, I have to disagree. I have to say no.
And we're back to the contradiction.
And we're back to the contradiction. I actually don't disagree with anything that you said. And I think that's actually why I feel strongly for saying that for the overall thesis, I am still in support of how Hades is and actually supports an immersive experience.
Okay.
Right. And it is going to come from a little bit of that narratological narrative immersion that we talk about, yeah. right? For me, I do think that the othering that you talk about with Marx and how you no longer, right, feel that you are feeling the progression of Zagreus, the more and more that you put into the game, the more hours and the more runs that you do, you end up turning on God mode because you're like, I need to actually, right, beat the story. I need to get more. Right. Yeah. And that's what I've heard people say, that they've played it for 45 runs and they're like, look, I just want to die a lot, get a lot better.
Can I ask you a question? You have a point? What is the state of mind that you're in when you make that? What is the state of mind that you, as Lauren, were in when you made that decision to turn on God mode?
What was the state of mind that I was yep. in? Okay, this is going to lead, this is going to lead into it, right? So I'm glad that you explained Brecht, because I do think that that point of alienation and the point of this de-straining, right, effect is incredibly important.
Yeah.
For me as a writer, I have to say that Hades is still an immersive experience because metagaming can still be considered an immersive experience.
Okay.
Something that you see in Dungeons and Dragons and something that you see a lot in like a lot of MMOs as well, or a lot of, say, I'll call them live service games, are things that you have to do every day or things that you have to do right before a raid yeah. or before a battle with a lot of people.
Yeah.
You also have things that are called like the best leveling charts or where to get the most resources. These are things that are considered metagaming. There's also the instance that I, as an avid metagamer, at least from terms of playing Dungeons and Dragons, I can see what will happen next in the story because I have gamed so much, or rather because I have, as a former dungeon master, I know what I would do.
Yeah.
And so the other night, I'm in a situation where my character would actually just pass out on the ground. That's how tired they are.
Yeah.
And they've been underground. So now they're going to play in the now they're like, I have sun. So I'm just going to lay here for 8 hours.
Yeah.
I came out of a sewer. I smell terrible. Everyone else is going to go take a bath. My character is like, you know what? I'm a sailor. I stink, but I don't care. I'm going to go lay in this bed of flowers. I don't care where they're from.
Yeah.
And I'm going to lay here. In the back of my head, I know this is what my character would do. But further back, I'm going, I bet if I lay here, there is another character is going to meet my character. Like if I was a dungeon master yeah. and one of the party split off, I was like, I would have another character to meet this character.
Yeah.
Because I would make it mean something. And sure enough, our dungeon master, right?
Yeah.
Has that. Now that's the mindset that I'm in.
Yeah.
Now I didn't actually make that choice, right? I made the choice because my character, you know, he described this beautiful field of flowers with sunshine, and my character being an elf
yeah.
is going to go lay in the flowers. But as a player, I'm going, wait a second, this actually is good for my character to do because I will meet another character that could be a key figure.
Yeah.
So let's take that and let's look at Zagreus's journey as a Hades, yeah. right? And let's look at it with, when do you turn on God mode?
Yes.
Right? In the synthesis of when you turn on God mode, that's when you as a player understand and are naturally completely immersed in the experience for me. That is when you recognize that you as a player are metagaming. You have been estranged and have been put aside to where you have to make the choice
yeah.
to become a god.
Eventually, because it sort of ramps up. It doesn't quite like make you a god right away.
Eventually, right? Yeah. Because it doesn't make you a god right away. But Zagreus himself, right? You belong with us. You belong on Olympus. You belong as a god, right?
Yeah.
He is the son. You could say he's the son of Hades, yeah. right? Hades is a god. He's technically a god. But he has not behaved like a god. He has trialed his life.
Well, in the Greek, right? In Greek mythology, he behaves very, fine, very right? appropriately for a god, actually. Being a whiny
right?
little...
Right, but he's a whiny little, you know, and a whiny little beep. And you have to... And he has trials, right? He's trying to earn his place by their side. But gods don't earn their place. They're gods, right?
Yeah, they just are.
And so when you... So even in the nature of the mechanic, we talked about how normally god mode is just you instantly become a god. That's not the design of Hades. Hades is you must suffer. You must fail to succeed. You must fail to gain the understanding. So when you choose that you are ready to be a god, you as the player are choosing as Zagreus. Zagreus is finally ready through whether it's early in the story or late in the story. And I'm going to use this in the context of the game's experience itself and not necessarily you saying, I'm going to start the game on God mode. Because quite frankly, I still think the argument holds up, but I understand where maybe people would not think it holds up for narrative or subjective immersion. Yeah. So I'll just fiat that right now. But when you decide to turn on God mode, you are ready. You are ready to just take on all of the challenges, and you are ready to rise to meet them in a way that will more align with the conventional standard, having not been in the conventional standard.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that this is actually not anti-immersion. I do think that it uses anti-immersion techniques. I actually do think that it uses Brecht's alienation and the estranging effect. And very early on, it breaks the fourth wall, even between that narrator, right? That third person impartial narrator, you could say, that is actually subjective. Very early on, where Zagreus talks back to him, and then he has to go, excuse me, I'm going to edit what I just said, because they can hear each other. And that's not just breaking the fourth wall for Zagreus, right? That's breaking the fourth wall for you as the player, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of shooting all the way up like the chorus would be doing. And that actually creates more immersion for you to feel like you, the player, are an active participant, just like in the Greek tragedies and the Shakespeare's plays, where the audience was considered an active participant. And that is why this is immersion.
So I don't think you're wrong. And in many ways, it's appropriate, because we're in sort of the synthesis portion of this, where like it's neither going to be your antithetical argument nor my thetical argument, if that's even a word. It's not really a word, but I guess you could create one.
It is now.
So the thing is, like, so in many ways, then it's appropriate to not use the language of the thesis in order to understand this. And I think you're right about that. The thing is, everything you just said, Brecht in many ways accounts for, precisely because it's interestingly enough, so that this is sort of like the meta Brecht perspective. Now we're going to talk about sort of like the history of like how he actually tried to implement these things. One of the problems, quote unquote problems, that Brecht often had is that his plays were too enjoyable. In other words, he had a hard time actually soliciting the very reaction in his audience that he wanted, because they were too fun. Because it was too easy to become engaged with them and be like, yeah, I can sit back and relax and have fun. Like, he had a hard time figuring out what you would actually do in the artistic product in order to solicit this reaction. He knew that you wanted this reaction, that you wanted to sort of like solicit this state of consciousness. So in many ways, actually, I think Hades does it better than Brecht did in reality. I think Brecht understood it better. In a way that it's possible that I'm going to read like memoir of like a super giant dev in the future and then be like, oh yeah, I read Brecht. I knew all about that. Screw you.
I wouldn't doubt it.
It's possible. I don't know.
Maybe one of them will listen to this and be like, dude, we referenced Brecht like all the time. Like, and then yeah, they did it better because they had him.
Well, no,
right?
I think the reason why they did it better, and I want to go back to that moment of when you decide to turn on God mode. And I also want to talk about one other thing, which is the narrative voice of the game, because there is an aloof narrative voice of the game that is never identified with a character. So the narrative voice, like every time you die, you hear this, like, you know, narrator opine, like, oh, you have died, now what will you do? Like, and that voice, the further you progress in the game, also starts to comment on sort of like metagame aspects of what you're doing, and starts commenting on the relationship between sort of like, in many ways, doesn't quite come out and say gameplay, but you see the obvious relationship between what the narrator is saying and sort of the gameplay mechanics that you as a player have to deal with. And because of that, it's almost like the game is not talking to you through the characters. The game is talking to you directly. It is addressing you as a player directly. And because it does that, because it doesn't just sort of like slip in these sort of anti-immersion mechanics within the context of the game, the fact that the game itself is now addressing you in the sort of like metagame, from this metagaming perspective, like that is a fundamentally different thing. Because the thing is, that is where it puts you and the game in the same world. In other words, it recognizes something about sort of the nature of metagaming that really you can't, doesn't get well thought out, in at least in philosophical terms, until sort of the so-called postmodern period, which is that actually there is no such thing as like a metatextual relationship. That in fact, all of these things that we perceive as metatextual, that we perceive as metagaming, they actually are just the text. They actually are just the game. I mean, unfortunately, and then, you know, it's the classic Derrida quote, there is no outside of the text. And what he means by that is that even the things that you perceive in terms of your consciousness as being an outside, by virtue of the fact that they are part of your consciousness and the way in which you sort of discursively interact with the world, then they have to be part of the world simply by virtue of that effect. And Brecht understood that. Because, and the reason why I say he understood that is precisely because what he was trying to get his audience to do is to actually take their understanding of what they were seeing before them and bring it back into the world of their lives. And that's true for Marx as well. The reason why you need to understand your alienated relationship to your own labor is so that you can bring that politically back into your own life and try to advocate for tearing down capitalism so as to get rid of this thing that forces you to do that. In other words, Marx, Brecht, Hades, the incredibly what all these people really understood fundamentally, even though they come from very different philosophical and very different intellectual traditions, is that all of these things are part of the world. And so the reason why I would say is that it breaks that subjective immersion is because that subjective immersion is based on a delusion. And the delusion is that sense of separation of yourself from the game world. In other words, the whole idea of immersion is based upon this idea that you can have a selfhood that is extant the game. But what the game is reminding you of is that no, this game, by virtue of the fact that you, the player, are sitting here playing it, it is now part of your life. Your experience of its narrative is part of your life. It is part of your world. It is not outside of the world. It may present the delusion or the illusion of an outside of your world, but it's not.
And see, and that is why I would say it is absolutely immersive, is because true games that leave a lasting impression upon you are games that, what I would consider immersion and subjective immersion, yeah, are the games that do exactly what you said right there. They are a part of the world. You are a part of their world. That world is already a part of your world. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in a game like Hades does that so well. And I do think that the Supergiant devs absolutely knew that. They knew that you and the game are in the same world, yeah, as in the same, this universe, this cosmology, this entire area.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's exactly what it is.
I mean, if we want to use, I think there's a really convenient Heideggerian term for this. Martin Heidegger, famous Nazi, but also a brilliant philosopher. I'm not going to unpack that. I want to unpack that, but I'm not going to unpack that. He uses this term in Being in Time, Umwelt, which literally means like the world around you. The is sort of around, surrounding, and the Welt is world, which in German literally just usually means environment, like in the sense, in the same way that we use environment in English. But he sort of deconstructs the term, you know, this idea of world around you, to sort of rethink about one's relationship to that world, because he too is trying to break down this notion of sort of like subject-object relationships, that like there is a world outside of me and there's myself, and that they relate to each other at a distance. He's trying to say like, no, you were always already in that world. And so it's important to think of it as an Umwelt and not just a Welt, precisely because it's always already surrounding you.
That's exactly what I think Hades is doing, and Hades is already, I guess, commenting on through its gameplay and through its narrative, right? Is that you are thinking that you're fighting against the world within the game,
yeah,
only to discover that the world isn't actually really fighting you.
No.
You could say. And then you realize that you still need to not maybe fight. I mean, it is fighting, the mechanic is fighting,
yeah,
but you still need to, right, overcome this world, but you are a part of that world. God mode is showing you how the world helps you, right, overcome it.
God mode actually helps you become a better part of that world in the way that, yes, Gregorius, yes, wants to relate to it. There is no overcoming.
That's a much, that is a much better phraseology, because I was going to end with that, but you're right. It is actually God mode itself that does that.
Yeah.
And I think that the player makes that choice.
Yes.
The game doesn't auto turn on God mode.
Yeah.
And you could finish it without it, to be honest, right?
You can. It's really hard, but you can. Yeah.
It's really hard, but you can as the player, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that people's reactions to God mode's going, I resisted it for so long. Not one person, not two people, not four people have said that to me.
Yeah.
But five people, that's a handful. Yeah. Okay. Five people have said, I resisted, as if the whole argument for checking that box was to resist it, right? And I think that that's, that in of itself is what creates that immersive effect that is you, Zagarias, you, the player, you, the world, right? It is all the same. And I think that's why Hades is such an incredible experience. And I'm really glad that we finally talked about it, because it's just, it is really what I think games are becoming if they can recognize it well.
Okay, so I do have a few final thoughts about Hades, though, just to wrap things up. So this is like the epilogue tour. So we've reached our like concluding point, and now we have our conclusion to like sort of sum things up. And one of the things that I want to emphasize is to go back to something that you were saying with regards to sort of your friends who said to you on several occasions, in fact, several different friends told you that I resisted in turning on God mode for so long, is because literally then their experience of disillusionment, of saying like, no, actually I'm not that perfect, like conventional player that I thought I was, is not identical to, but analogous to Zagreus's disillusionment. You don't, it's not just experience it. So in many ways, you're right. It's sort of more immersive than even like the classical like game industry notion of immersion even can be. Because what it's literally doing is it's sort of, it's burrowing into your life, and it's causing you as a person to have that experience of disillusionment that, frankly, I can't think of a game that does this. I literally cannot think of another game that has ever done this. And I had this experience. My daughter had this experience. You had this experience. And the thing is, like, I've also watched, like, you know, these guys on YouTube who have never used God mode before. And what's interesting to me is, like, how unrelatable they feel to me. Like, I'm not an amazing, like, I'm not a world champion at anything. I'm not super spectacular at any particular game I play. However, I oftentimes at least feel like I can relate to those people. So like, you know, sometimes like if I'm watching, I don't know. So I love to play Total War games because I love grand strategy games. And sometimes if I'm stuck on something in a game where like I've encountered something that I find really difficult, or I don't know sort of like ideal army builds or whatever, like I will then go to those top tier players to sort of find something that I can model myself on. Whereas when I look at people who like play Hades in this way, at this like really high end, I don't find anything in their gameplay that I can relate to. And that is actually more alienating than anything else.
Yeah, my final thoughts on Hades, man, are right up that alley. I think, you know, for me, it really comes back to all of the study that I did on Foucault, where basically the premise is that in order to understand inside of you, you need to also understand what is outside of you and the reflections between that. And for me, when you look at failure as a mechanic from a game design standpoint, it is something that all games have. And we've all tried to figure out how do we get the player to feel better about failing. That's a common concept, right? Yeah. It's going back to the practical. And when we look at Hades and our cult of immersion, we realize that Hades does something incredibly special because it does change how you feel about playing the game.
Yeah.
And it does change the relatability, not just of you to yourself, and then you turn on God mode or continue to fight through it, right? But it also trains you to think differently about failure.
Yeah.
Right? And it trains it because the world of the game itself has allowed you as the, and encourages you as the player to look at failure as not something to avoid, but something to recognize and to internalize.
Yeah.
And then also the narrative layers on top of that with Zagreus, who goes, well, failure is just a part of life, right? And then it's only when you allow the world to come almost inside of you in sort of in the mechanical way, yeah. right? Which God mode basically just increases your defenses.
Yeah.
It is not invulnerability, just so everyone's clear on what God mode is in this. And it's because a God is not defined by his invulnerability. It is defined, right? This is like the argument of the mechanic, just so that we're clear, and not necessarily the argument of the narrative, which I have not finished. So if this is the argument of the narrative, Nicholas will say nothing. But that a God is not defined by his actual immense power or invulnerability, but by how he reacts, right, to the trials that he goes through, not even overcomes, right? It's just the trials that he goes through. And yeah. I think you kind of see this in the classic Greek myths. You see it in many stories, right? And also what Nicholas points out at the very end, where streamers who are at such the high end tier then end up not using God mode, that don't rely on the world, that don't relate to the chorus members, not suddenly aren't related to other players, because we no longer see them as someone who is going through those trials and then ends up relying on others, the chorus and the world. It's like they're distant from us. They don't have to have that.
Well, they're kind of sad. They're kind of sad.
It's kind of,
because if one of the fundamental messages of the game, where, so as I noted, when you reach the key person as Zagreus that you're supposed to reach, the game at that point forces you to fail. And the reason why it forces you to fail is because the thing that it's trying to tell you is that you were doing it wrong. And so persisting in this mode of like, and the thing is, like, the game allows for it. One of the things, I mean, because of the way the gameplay is actually designed, like the power-up system and the fact that you can do all sorts of different builds, and you have to have variety in builds because you don't necessarily know what boons you're going to get. Like, but in persisting in that, in many ways, it's sort of analogous to what we talked about a long time ago in terms of like the Freudian repetition compulsion. It's that like they are stuck, strangely. Like the person who is showing off their like immense skill, because the thing is, it is real skill. Like you have to have really amazing Twitch skills to play that game at an extremely high level. It is so fast. It is ridiculous. However, there is a way to read this game to sort of say, actually, the experience that I, my daughter, Lauren, her friends, all of these people who are not the best, actually have a healthier experience of the game and a more appropriate experience of the game. And that the person who persists in sort of repeating this conventional mode of gameplay, where you have to try and do it without God mode, or you have to try and do it without actually coming to that sort of visceral gameplay realization that is analogous to Zagreus's more narrative realization in terms of his own life. Like, they are sad precisely because they never allow themselves to be disillusioned. They persist in the illusion.
I have no new tales left to tell, but do not think that you have won, Prince Zagreus. For any tale worth telling is a tale worth telling again and again and again. Bye-bye.